Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Spring is a welcome time of year, but it also means we must be more vigilant about ticks and tick bites. Black-legged ticks and Lone Star ticks can transmit diseases that are serious to humans. Today, we discuss the prevalence of tick-borne illnesses in our region, new research into best practices to prevent tick bites, and how to recognize and treat tick-borne illnesses. Joining us is Dr. Tim Lepery, physician on Nantucket, who's been treating patients with tick-borne illness for decades. Welcome, Dr. Lepery. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Stephen Rich is professor of microbiology at UMass Amherst and director of the New England Center of Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning.
And Patrick Roden Reynolds, public health biologist and head of the Martha's Vineyard Tick Program. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Dr. Lepper, you've been seeing tick bite patients for years. What are the most common tick-borne illnesses that you run across, and has that changed over time?
It hasn't changed over time. I mean, if somebody gets off the asphalt or gets off the boat, then they think they automatically have Lyme disease. But Lyme is certainly the most prevalent in all of its stages. Then Babesia, then Anaplasma, and then lesser ones, tularemia. We see probably 10 cases over the last couple of years. We have not had a case of Powassan's encephalitis that is seen more on the mainland.
So, Stephen, what are the types of ticks that we see in our region? There's several different ones, right?
Yeah, so the black-legged tick is the main culprit with the transmission of the pathogens that Dr. Lepper mentioned. And then dog ticks. And now there's a newcomer, which is the Lone Star tick, which is moving from the south northward and becoming established on the Cape and Islands.
Yeah. We also have the Asian longhorn ticks, but they don't seem to be biting humans, right?
Mostly a livestock tick, yeah.
Yeah. So if you find a tick embedded, what's the best course of action, Dr. Lepery? Should we assume the tick is carrying disease? What do you do when somebody comes and says, "Up, I've had this tick embedded"?
Well, the first thing I tell them is do tick checks so they don't get embedded. I mean, that's the critical part of all of this. But if a tick is embedded and they have a significant tick bite, then I would consider the possibility of giving me a sort of a prophylactic dose of doxycycline. That's been shown to be effective. It doesn't particularly protect you against Babesia and really has only been proven to be used in Lyme disease. But like I said, first thing is don't get bitten.
Yeah. So what are the treatment regimes for more common tick-borne illnesses? You mentioned Lyme disease. What if it is babesiosis or anaplasmosis? What's the treatment?
Lyme disease is going to be doxycycline, amoxicillin, those drugs. With babesia, it's Mepron and Zithromax. With anaplasma, it's doxycycline. With tularemia, it's doxycycline. With Powassan's, there is no treatment. And Borrelia myomotoi is also amoxicillin, doxycycline. Yeah. That's a very uncommon one because we don't look for it, although it's probably as common as Lyme disease.
Oh. So some people diagnosed with a tick-borne illness claim they never found a tick. How common is this? And what should we know about the time it takes for a tick to infect us with a pathogen? Anybody?
Well, I tell people to get a good friend or a relative or a spouse so that you can take a look at the places that you can't see. I mean, I see the preponderance of tick bites to be under the arms, behind the knee, on the back, in certain nether regions that you need somebody to take a look. That's the key. And tick checks are the ultimate answer, although it's the easiest and less sexy way of dealing with ticks.
Yeah. Stephen, what do we know about the time it takes for a tick to infect us with a pathogen?
So the tick feeding is important to understand that it's a complex biological process, and the tick is taking things out of the person that it's biting and it's spitting things in at the same time. Very complex set of stages. And only at certain portions of that stage does the pathogen move from the tick into the host. So for things like Borrelia, for the Lyme disease spirochete, it probably takes at least 48 hours for the spirochete to move out of the tick into the host. other things like Powassan virus are thought to transmit much more rapidly, although there's not a lot of studies that have been done in humans because, as Doctor mentioned, it's not a common infection. So yeah, it takes some time for the things to move out of the tick into the host.
Yeah. What are some of the warning signs we might be infected with some of the more common diseases like Lyme disease or anaplasmosis or babesiosis? I mean, everything seems like flu-like symptoms we always hear, right? So what would concern you? What should you be looking for?
If a patient comes in to me and tells me they feel like they've been hit by a truck with night sweats, bed shaking, chills, and sweating gobs and high fevers, then I'm pretty sure it's babesia. With Lyme disease, it's much more subtle. I mean, if you don't have a rash, it gets a little bit iffy. If you don't, like I said, have a good friend or a spouse to check. Anaplasma, people can get pretty sick with, although not as sick as I've seen with babesiosis. Borrelia myomatoid presents very much like a relapsing fever, but a headache is probably a more predominant feature. It doesn't have a rash, and people complain of the headache more. Powassan's is an encephalitis. As I said, we haven't had a case on the island, but there are cases on the mainland, a few cases a year. But it's that there's very little you can do about it, and it has horrible consequences.
Yeah. Anybody want to add anything to that, what we should be looking for? Because you hear a lot of people say they didn't even know they had Lyme disease, and then it turns out they've had it for a while, and that can be pretty serious, right?
Well, yeah,
go ahead, Stephen.
I was just going to mention the rash, too. So the erythema migrans rash, which evidently doesn't occur in every patient, but it is something that's a pretty telltale for Lyme. So it's something to watch for.
Yeah. Are there differences in how these diseases impact children or adolescents versus adults?
Well, I think as far as Lyme disease goes, the sooner you find it, the better people do. I mean, the worst thing is I see, let's say December through February, I have one or two people come in, kids, with a big red swollen knee, which is a later stage of Lyme disease. With adults, I mean, Lyme disease has associated facial palsy, which can be very disturbing, and then Lyme arthritis. It's better to be suspicious and to treat early and pick it up early and treat early with any of these.
Yeah, you mentioned when you might have a kid come in with a swollen knee and that as a sign of a later stages. What is the treatment at that point? When it's a later stage, does it get more difficult to treat?
No, it's treatable.
Yeah.
It's treatable. Lyme disease is treatable at all stages.
Okay.
But there may be damage from the infection. I prefer not to be stuck with somebody with a big red swollen knee that has Lyme disease.
Yeah.
But it's treatable at all stages.
Right. Are there long-term complications from these diseases, even if you get treatment right away, or is it, you know, what would be the long-term complications?
Well, certainly early Lyme disease, as Steve alluded to, with a rash, people do very, very well. That's not a question. The question is people who have persistent symptoms after having had Lyme disease and been treated appropriately. And that there isn't any great evidence that I've seen that is persistence of organisms, because that's really the question. Do we have bugs? Do we need more drugs? And the answer is right now, it seems to be probably more of an immune dysregulation that is leading to persistent symptoms. The persistent symptoms are real, okay? They're real. People aren't crazy. People have been treated like they're crazy or fobbed off on somebody. We don't really understand the issue, but it's not persistent organisms. Mm. No bugs, no drugs.
Yeah. Patrick, we see a lot of the Lone Star ticks on the vineyard. Do you know if we've seen any Powassan's disease there on the vineyard each year? I don't know if you know the answer to that.
So we've had one case, I believe, in the past 5 years. But Powassan is a deer tick associated, or black-legged tick.
What's the Lone Star tick thing that you get that, that creates the allergy to meat or whatever, the protein in meat?
Alpha-gal syndrome,
Yeah.
or like a mammalian meat allergy, the red meat allergy. That's probably the main thing we're concerned about with Lone Stars right now. But ehrlichiosis is probably the main disease that is transmitted by Lone Stars.
Right. So there were trials underway locally for Lyme disease vaccines, and those trials were halted. What do you know about where those clinical trials stand and how soon the vaccine could be available? Maybe that's a question for you, Stephen.
Actually, I'd turn that over to Doc because he's probably got a
Okay.
bit more
All
insight than
right.
that.
Go ahead, Dr.
Yeah.
LaFrey. Yeah.
The Lyme vaccine that came out in the 90s was very effective, and it was shut down because there was a limited audience for the vaccine. You were really talking about a coastal, East Coastal areas and lawyers. So it was shut down. The vaccine that's coming out recently is the same vaccine. It's a what we call an OspA vaccine. It's got little pieces of chrome hung on it, but it's essentially the same. It is an effective vaccine. It is a safe vaccine. You know, I participated in the trials in the 90s, and the worst side effect I saw was one of the hospital administrator's secretary got a sore arm. Well, we knew she had gotten the full dose of vaccine because that's when you get a sore arm. You didn't get it with the placebo. But the vaccine was effective. The vaccine was safe. Why the Vineyard and Nantucket and the Block got shut out of the vaccine trials is still a mystery to me. And I think it probably had to do with the company being able to get effective data from fewer patients that they had to pay to get participate in the trial. That's just perhaps a jaundiced view of it.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, they go, well, we have the, you know, Lyme vaccine for our dogs. Why can't we have them for humans? And is it the same? Is it a similar vaccine? Is it
It's
something?
essentially it's the
Yeah.
same vaccine.
Yeah.
It's
So
an OspA vaccine.
yeah. So is the Lyme vaccine a one and done kind of thing, or do you need boosters? How does it work?
It's going to be a series of three injections, I believe, with boosters. And it's an effective, safe vaccine, but the problem is I've had people tell me that they got Lyme disease from the vaccine. Well, it's a recombinant DNA vaccine. A tick has not been near it. You can't get Lyme disease from a recombinant DNA vaccine. But people are convinced they can. I mean, there are a couple of videos out, Under Our Skin for one, that will has people twitching and falling on the floor, but I don't think they have Lyme disease, but
Yeah.
it makes good press.
Are you aware of any research into vaccines for other tick-borne illnesses? You know, I'm thinking about, you know, especially for people who are in high-risk regions or people who work outside in tick habitats.
I think a vaccine that would protect against tick saliva or would react to tick saliva is probably the one thing that would work. You know, you can get a vaccine against Lyme disease, but what are you going to do about Babesia, Anaplasma, or the other ones?
Right. So as far as you know, there isn't anything in it that they're looking at other than Lyme
No,
disease.
there was the mouse study where they were going to release immunized mice that were highly immunized and hopefully reduce the number of ticks around. I don't know where that is. That was coming out of MIT, and they were going to release 500,000 mice. Well, you need a ship to get that many mice, and they would be released in the spring when the mouse population is low. And the hope was to cut down on the infected number of mice on the island. They were highly immunized.
Yeah. Dr. Tim Lepre's family physician on Nantucket, who's been treating patients with tick-borne illnesses for decades. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us this morning. We appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Coming up after break, how to prevent tick bites and research into best practices for reducing our exposure to ticks. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about ticks, tick-borne illness, and best practices to prevent tick bites. With us is Stephen Rich, professor of microbiology at UMass Amherst and director of the New England Center of Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases, and Patrick Roden Reynolds, public health biologist and head of the Martha's Vineyard Tick Program. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Patrick, as part of your work on the vineyard, you conduct tick surveys. What are you finding for the number and kind of ticks? And are you seeing any changes in or trends in the data that you're collecting?
For this year or overall?
Both.
So this year it's a little early. So I start doing my surveys early March, but I would say peak tick season's kind of starting today, if not into mid-May and early June is when we find the most ticks. So we typically wait to do a lot of our residential yard surveys May 15th through July 31st. But over the years, one thing interesting I've found the 3 years I've been here is we do find ticks emerging, or at least adult ticks, in March and April now. You know, the first adult Lone Stars I find come out in March on the vineyard, and even the first nymphs I find are out in April.
And those are for the Lone Star, but we have the black-legged ticks year-round, right? They're here year-round.
Yeah, the deer ticks. So the risk of getting a tick bite is all year long with the three species we have on the Cape and Islands and here in the Northeast, the deer tick, dog tick, and Lone Star. Deer tick adults are essentially active from September through the winter and into April and May. The adult stage of the deer tick they're slowly dwindling away essentially this time of year. May is still, you know, it's Lyme disease awareness month. It's still a big month for deer ticks, but the nymphs are now emerging and becoming the main kind of issue.
Stephen, talk a little bit about when these ticks might be more apt to be carrying Lyme disease. I mean, is a spring bite less risky than a fall bite when they've, you know, had their meals? What does that cycle look like?
Yeah, it's a little complicated because it's the adult ticks that have the higher infection rate, because an adult, by definition, has eaten twice on a host. So that's two chances to get infection, whereas nymphal ticks have only fed once. But what's a little bit confusing about that is it's the nymphal ticks that seem to be more risky, and it's not so much about the rates of infection that are probably half in those ticks, but it's about the size of the tick. The nymphal ticks are much smaller, and so they have a higher likelihood of feeding and going undetected and then being on long enough to transmit their pathogen. Mm-hmm. So it's all really about timing, about how long the tick, not just the infection, but how long the ticks feed. Smaller ticks feed longer because we don't find them as easily.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, are the ticks you're collecting in the surveys tested for disease? And if so, what are you finding in terms of the numbers of them carrying disease?
So I do send out some of the ticks we collect, and some of get pathogen tested. Sam Telford is one of our collaborators. If not, I send some ticks to Steve Rich and company through various surveys I do, whether we pull in ticks off the deer or actual tick surveys. So at least pathogen testing, we have good data on deer ticks. And at least my understanding is that it doesn't change much over time. There's essentially a floating average. I think if we look back at 10 years worth of data, the deer tick nymph infection rate with Lyme disease floats anywhere from like 12 to 25%. With like the annual or the average, you know, being around 15 or 17%, but it can go down up and down from year to year.
Right. Let's talk to Paul, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Patrick, I think I might have met you at the West Tisbury Library. Did you, was Richard Johnson your mentor?
Yes, Richard. Hello? He's been doing the tick program since 2010.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, because I think at one time we lost funding for it. So my question for you goes to prevention, where Richard mentioned once upon a time, get toilet roll inserts, you know, just the cardboard middle part, stuff it with cotton, pour permethrin on it, and scatter it around your yard, because what the ticks in many cases, don't actually jump right onto us. They go to a carrier, rabbits, squirrels, etc. And the permethrin on the cotton is supposed to, I don't know, discard the ticks or get on the fur of the animal. And I don't know. My question is this actually effective? Because for years, I have been saving every roll of toilet paper and filling it with cotton and pouring permethrin and putting it all around my yard. And I don't know if it's effective.
Yeah.
Right.
Paul, good question. Thanks, Paul. Go ahead. Go ahead, Patrick.
No, this you're referring to the tick tubes, which are, they're sold by a company's Thermacell, but a lot of people make their own. It's not my first recommendation I make for tick prevention in the yard and reducing your tick bites. It's not going to hurt if you do it. There are just a few considerations to remember with the tick tubes. The idea, if you're not familiar with a tick tube, is you take a toilet paper roll, shove it with cotton that's been impregnated or soaked in a permethrin, and the idea is mice will come up, take the cotton back to their nest, use it as a nesting material, and that will kill or treat the ticks on the mice, kind of effectively destroying that cycle of where the ticks are picking up the diseases in the first place.
Is it probably better to spray that permethrin on your socks and shoes, right?
If we want to cut to the point of it, I would rather focus on permethrin-treated clothing, shoes, and socks. Sometimes it can be hard to wear long pants around the house in the summertime, but if you focus on permethrin-treated clothing, that'll be by far the best thing you can do to prevent tick bites.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the call, Paul. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Cindy writes, I'm glad you're covering this important topic. I wanted to remind everyone that if you do find a tick on you, once you remove it, you can send it to UMass Amherst for tick testing. They can identify it and test it for various pathogens. It is a very informative, user-friendly website, and the results are very thorough. It can also let you and your doctor know about the results. Unfortunately, it's not free. Years ago, the state did offer them a grant to reduce the cost for us. Is there any chance they may bring that back? So, Stephen, tell us about this program you run, and to Cindy's point, any chance we're going to see some funding to make it free again?
There's a couple of points to clarify there. So the program she's talking about is Tick Report, which is found at tickreport.com, and it's no longer housed at the University of Massachusetts. It's actually been taken off campus, and I have to disclose that I'm a part owner of that operation. So it still runs as it always did, doing public service and trying to do public health research. As far as whether it's ever going to be subsidized, that's one of the reasons we try to take it off, is to try to figure out better ways to fund it. It's always been reliant on the subscribers that pay for the service. It doesn't seem like, for one thing, the CDC doesn't feel like tick testing is particularly effective. We feel otherwise. We feel like it's actually helped a lot to inform people about their exposures.
Well, also, I mean, especially I think for parents, when you send that tick in, it's just a relief to go, oh, good, there was nothing, there was nothing in that tick, or there was, right? So, what are you learning from the data set that you've collected so far?
Well, just to highlight one of the most recent things that's coming out in a paper shortly is we've looked at ticks that are positive for Powassan, that are infected with Powassan, that have fed on people. And we've looked at a couple dozen of these now and found that there's no evidence of those ticks transmitting to people. So probably in addition to the fact that the infection rate with things like Powassan is very low, we think that probably the rate at which even that low incidence of ticks give the infection to people is very low. So I think it's every bit as important to know about what the serious risks are, the present risks, as it is to sort of put in context the ones that are much more rare.
Eleanor writes, is there a lab that will analyze the tick one removes after bite? I brought the Lone Star tick, which bit me in June 23, to the laboratory at Mass General Hospital. I had identified and labeled it as a Lone Star tick. My interest was in discovering presence of disease. 5 days later, I received this analysis. Result, Lone Star tick, period. Any suggestions? So for people who do want to send a tick in, it's a website, Stephen, that they can?
Yeah, it's tickreport.com.
Okay. All right. So, and the other one, we mentioned dog ticks, but do dog ticks carry anything we need to be worried about? any kind of, disease?
Dog ticks can be associated with some infections, but they're very rare. So not so often with the dog ticks. It's really the black-legged ticks that are the biggest ones for pathogens, and then the Lone Star ticks, which are the concern because of the alpha-gal syndrome, the red meat allergy.
And there's a difference in their habitats. Patrick, tell us a little bit. Right now in our area, that Martha's Vineyard seems to be the hot spot for Lone Star ticks, right? So tell us where we find them, what their habitat and lifespan is like.
Yeah, the Lone Stars are a little bit of a insidious tick. So if we dog ticks, it's open grassy areas, grassy meadows, open direct sunlight. Deer ticks, forested areas where there's leaf litter on the ground and there's shade from the trees above. Lone Stars
Anywhere,
intermix between the both. We'll find them in open areas, typically not as much as dog ticks, but we'll also find them in forested leaf litter areas, typically not as much as deer ticks, but they're much more robust tick and they can withstand more habitats.
And what are you finding in terms of their populations? I mean, we had a lot of the black-legged ticks, and then the Lone Star ticks come in. Are they displacing the black-legged ticks? Are they, coexisting? What are we finding as far as numbers?
That's one question we did have is so the Lone Stars really started showing up in numbers in 2010 on the vineyard. I think they can be dated back to earlier and even in the 90s, but it wasn't until 2010 and certainly not till 2015 that they started spreading across the island. So they first started showing up in Aquinnah and Chappaquiddick, which would be like the southwest and the southeast corners of Martha's Vineyard. And they proliferated there for a few years, and then it wasn't around 2015, 2016, they started spreading northward across the vineyard. So now we find them in all six towns on the island. They're rare on Nantucket, but they can be found there. They're certainly more abundant, if not the dominant tick, where we have originally found them in Aquinnah and Chappaquiddick. So we're finding equal amounts of Lone Stars and deer ticks, if not more Lone Star ticks. Whereas the north part of the island, deer ticks are still the dominant tick.
And we find them both obviously on the Cape as well, where there's Lone Star ticks here as well. And there's a difference in the black-legged ticks are hanging out, right? And they're waiting for you to come to them, where the Lone Star ticks, they see you and come to you, right?
Yeah, so all ticks have a questing behavior where they get on the edge of a blade of grass or a twig. They stick out of their front legs and they wait for something to physically brush up against you and then they go for a ride. So all ticks do that. Deer ticks are, that's really the only way they host for or quest for a tick. Dog ticks and Lone Stars, especially Lone Stars, have more active host-seeking behavior, where if they sense something, which I think is typically like carbon dioxide, they can crawl towards that host. One example is there's a dry ice trap in the south is a common way to collect ticks. You dig a hole in the ground, drop a couple chunks of dry ice, which emits carbon dioxide gas. Surround the hole with double-sided tape, and you come back in the morning and see how many ticks flock towards the ice trying to get towards that source of CO2 and got themselves stuck to the tape. Whereas deer ticks, I don't think that would really work.
So how do you advise people to avoid tick bites? What do you tell people?
For me, the number you won't have a conversation with me about tick prevention without permethrin treated clothing or use of some repellent on your exposed skin. I've been on the vineyard 3 years going on my third tick season. I'm regularly looking for ticks. I have a full outfit during my work, boots, socks, pants, and a shirt. Tucked in clothing is important too. All permethrin treated. When I'm dressed like that, I feel completely safe. I don't get tick bites, knock on wood. I haven't had tick bites since I moved here yet, and I don't worry about it when I'm out in the woods dressed appropriately.
Stephen, do you do the same thing?
I do. Yeah, that's the I agree completely with Patrick. That's the number one recommendation is permethrin treated clothing.
Yeah. I have to say, when I send my grandson off to camp, I have a set of his socks and his shoes. I spray that because he's not going to wear long pants, but I spray his socks and his shoes, and that's what he brings and wears to camp. And so far, knock on whatever this is, he's not come home with any ticks from camp. Although he did get one on his head in a Boy Scout overnight camping trip, and his hair is so dark, I did not see it. And it was the doctor who actually found it. He said his head hurt, but and of course it was a deer tick. But, and immediately they put him on, the antibiotic or whatever to treat it just in case. But Suzanne on Nantucket writes, can you recommend a particular brand of permethrin that is safe to spray on the shoes, socks, and clothes of kids and adults?
I don't know if Steve has a comment. So for me, all permethrin that is marketed and sold to spray on your clothing is the same concentration. It's all 0.5% concentration. So it's not like DEET where you can buy 10%, 25%, or 40%. So all the permethrin should be equally effective. Sometimes it's sold in a pump spray bottle versus an aerosol can. So it's just, I think it boils down to how many fluid ounces of product are you getting for the price. My personal choice and what I recommend to a lot of folks is sending your clothes off to get professionally treated. Insect Shield is a company that will do that. If you do your at-home treatments, which I still have bottles of permethrin that I spray my own clothes and particularly my shoes with, the at-home spray lasts anywhere from 6 washings to 6 weeks, so mm-hmm. about 40 days, 42 days. If you send your clothing off to get professionally treated, it lasts 70 washings. Wow. So it lasts all year long. Wow. And for me, who garden regularly, hike regularly, I'm outdoors regularly, hunting and fishing and working regularly, even for like contractors who are out and around the houses that they work regularly, I highly recommend sending in clothing to be treated.
Don't put it on your skin, right?
Correct.
That's not
correct.
Something you can put on your skin. You put it on your clothes, but not your skin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's easy. Permethrin is very easy to use. It's safe to use when used correctly. Just read the instructions on the back of the bottle.
Right.
It's not to be used on skin.
Yeah, we're talking about ticks this morning, tick-borne illnesses, new research and best practices to prevent tick bites. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing ticks, tick-borne illness, and best practices to prevent tick bites. With us is Stephen Rich, professor of microbiology at UMass Amherst and director of the New England Center of Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases, and Patrick Roden Reynolds, public health biologist and head of the Martha's Vineyard Tick Program. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. David is giving us a call from Marston's Mills. Hi, David.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
So I got a tick recently, and it didn't blow up. It was just the head was in, and its butt was in the air, but it did not inflate with any blood. So first question is that something where I should feel that it's a quote unquote tick bite that's worth doing additional research or having concern about? And then the second question is, if I haven't gotten subsequently sick or had any symptoms whatsoever, is that indicative of having not contracted a tick-borne illness?
Who wants to answer that?
I'll take a stab at that. So it's difficult to say how long the tick might have been on you. It does take a while before they, I think you said, blow up. It takes a while before they fill up with blood. Sometimes that can take several days. So there's a chance that the tick could have been on you long enough to take whatever's inside it and deposit it into you. It's a little bit difficult to say without actually seeing the tick. And as far as, you know, if you're feeling fine, that's great. If you're not having any symptoms, just remember that you had the tick bite. You know, keep an eye on the spot where you had the tick bite, because the rashes and symptoms that might be associated with things like Lyme will radiate from the site of that bite. So watch for that. And just be mindful of the fact that you had that exposure. And if you have these, like Mindy said, they're febrile illness, the flu-like symptoms, mm-hmm. then remember back that a couple of weeks ago, because it does take, and that's one of the reasons that people report they don't recall having a tick bite, is they get bit by a tick. It takes an incubation period before that infection becomes established in you, and you may have forgotten about, you know, that exposure that you had in the past. So be mindful of it. Think about, you know, figuring out maybe what kind of tick it is. That's another thing to know. Of the three ticks that usually bite people in the Cape and Islands, Lone Star ticks, black-legged ticks, and deer ticks, it's those black-legged ticks that are most risky. So see which kind yours is.
Yeah. Deborah's giving us a call from East Falmouth. Hi, Deborah.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I walk dogs regularly, and they will get a tick on them. Sometimes I'm able to see it right away, get it off. Sometimes I don't notice it till we're home or sometimes the tick may leave the dog and may be on something in the house. What's the best product to protect the dogs, or so that it doesn't get on them and therefore get carried back into the home?
Yeah, it's a tough problem. I get that question a lot of folks with pet owners here on the vineyard, and it's an inherent risk of having a pet. Even though most of the pets either have an oral medication or a collar that is, you know, will keep them safe from getting disease, it doesn't stop the dog from picking up 20 ticks on their walk and then depositing them on your couch when you're back home an hour later. They do make some products as repellents for dogs. That's up to you if you want to use them. The best tip I can give is maybe permethrin treat a dog blanket. And when you're inside, you know, whether the dog stays on the couch or on the dog bed, have the dog stay on a permethrin treated blanket. That way, any ticks that are brought inside and then drop off the dog to go find something else, they at least contact that blanket first.
And that and kills hopefully them. Yeah, and that kills
that'll
them.
Kill them. Yeah. Hopefully you don't have ticks crawling across your bed or your laundry or your couch, which often happens.
Yeah. Steve, the New England Center of Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases is starting a research project to find out what strategies are most effective for preventing tick bites. Tell us a little bit more about that project.
Yeah, we came up with a clever name of Project Itch, I-T-C-H, meaning is tick control helping? So this was the brainstorm of my colleague Tom Mather at the University of Rhode Island. And what we're really trying to do is figure out whether these backyard sprays that people are paying for are effective at first killing ticks. And then, of course, the bigger question is it preventing the disease transmission. So this is a project that we're doing across New England. And it's in its second year now. In the first year, we were collecting baseline data just to see where the ticks were located. We knew a lot about the Cape and the Islands. We didn't know so much about northern Vermont and parts of Maine, et cetera. So we just saw where the ticks are. But we also did a lot of questioning about what people are doing in different parts of New England. And it turns out that it's not the same throughout the region. So one of the things we're learning is that there's use of, you know, there's synthetic chemistries that can be used, things like bifenthrin, which we know are effective at killing ticks if they're applied properly. But then there's other products like cedar tree oil that the jury's out about how effective those are at killing ticks. Mm. So we're doing this research in people's backyards so that it's more relevant and people understand precisely what they're paying for. Mm-hmm. The great news is, from my perspective, is the PCOs, or the pesticide control operators, groups like Fowler & Son on Cape Cod and Bartlett Tree Service. These groups are great partners for us because they want to know as much as we want to know whether these are being infected, because they have the best interest of their customers in mind, and we think that's a good sign.
A lot of folks are spraying their yards, right? And then there's others who are saying that's not a good idea because of the dangers it poses to pollinators and other insects. What are your thoughts on spraying your yard for ticks?
So those are the things we're testing, along with things like the tick tubes. So the products that are used are insecticides. So they will kill insects as well as ticks. The thought is that if they're sprayed not too liberally, but sort of spread along the boundaries of properties, that they can be more targeted towards ticks. But there is some evidence. We just heard last week a report from a group in Vermont that's looking at the impact on insects, that it is reducing, that those do reduce insect diversity in properties that are treated. So they're not without consequences.
Yeah. And I guess it's a good idea if you're going to do that to, like you mentioned, two very reputable companies. There are a lot of companies. And how much training, you know, do you have just some, you know, college kids who are spraying everything? You know, what kind of training are the people having that are spraying your yard? It's all worth looking into, right? Because you want to use these things according to the directions, right?
Exactly. There's that, and there's also the DIY, individuals that are buying the products and applying themselves, and you know, well-meaning but maybe not the most effective use of those chemistries.
All right. So we have Elizabeth says, "I'm terrified of ticks and don't go into the backyard without wearing boots at all times of year, including summer. Can ticks stick to the rubber?"
Oh yeah, they'll climb the rubber boots. That said, they are better. They are better footwear than mostly anything. If I'm not wearing regular leather hiking boots that are permethrin treated. During my surveys, I'm wearing knee-high rubber boots, and I've seen the Lone Star being the fastest tick. Some will make it over that rubber and onto pant leg or skin, but some do slip off, even when, because I don't treat my, you don't treat rubber boots.
Right. There's also the Lone Star ticks are more apt to bite you right away when they get on you, right? Where the other ticks kind of crawl up and find a spot they like. Is that accurate? I mean, that maybe you're more apt to find a black-legged tick crawling on you before it connects, where the Lone Star tick will bite you right away.
Well, they're doing the same thing. It's just that the Lone Star ticks are traveling faster, but they're both going to search around on your body for the right place for them to feed. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's worth just emphasizing in case people don't know. So permethrin is an insecticide. It's a pesticide. It kills ticks. So when you put it on your clothing, what you're doing is killing the ticks that come in contact with it. And it's important to know the difference between that and repellents, mm-hmm. things like DEET, which may prevent a tick from feeding on you, and you put it directly on your skin, but they don't kill ticks.
And that's why you don't want to put the permethrin on your skin. You want to put it on the clothes and shoes, but not your skin. Yeah.
That, and it's engineered to be on clothing and not on skin.
Steve, you're also doing research into a repellent targeted specifically for ticks, a spatial repellent. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's something we've grown in our lab for the last several years. One is spatial repellents. And I'll tell you, when it first... our colleague at MIT brought this idea to us, Noel Elman. We thought spatial repellents don't seem like they were going to work particularly well with ticks, but it does seem that they have a place, and that the difference between a spatial repellent and a contact repellent, which DEET is a contact repellent, is, as the name implies, contact repellents work when the tick comes in contact physically, like it's crawling on you and then it comes to a spot of your skin that's been treated and they're repelled away from that site. Spatial repellents are ones that have been used for a number of years against mosquitoes. And the idea is it sort of produces a cloud of repellency around the individual. We didn't know how that would work with ticks, but in our preliminary studies, it seems like it works effectively against keeping ticks from going places that we don't want to go, like on our person. Mm. There are also some new compounds that we're looking at, things like nootkatoon, which are natural compounds derived from grapefruit and different types of cedar. And they also seem to be effective repellents for people that aren't interested in synthetic chemistries on their body.
Yeah. Is there any research that you know of that's trying to find a way to prevent ticks from carrying disease?
So that's a very good question. So it's important to remember that all of the diseases that we talk about, Lyme disease, Babesia, and Anaplasma, they're not really, they cause disease in humans, but they're not human diseases proper. We say they're zoonoses, meaning they're diseases that are transmitted usually between mice by ticks. And so we are kind of accidental hosts, and we don't give infection back to ticks, nor do we give infection to each other. So to reduce the source of infection, we have to go and treat the animals that are the primary reservoirs. That's an important thing to remember. Like, we hear a lot about herd immunity when COVID was happening, and we knew the need for vaccinating a critical number of people so that other people that may not be able to take the vaccine could be protected. There's no effective herd immunity when you vaccinate for a zoonosis. So if the Lyme vaccine that we talked about earlier does come about, it's not going to do anything to reduce the rate of infection. In order to reduce the rate of infection, you'd have to be vaccinating the white-footed mice or the primary reservoirs. And so there are efforts to do that. We talked earlier about the mouse study that's a transgenic mouse that would be refractory. It's not actually going to reduce the number of feeding ticks. It's going to reduce the number of, in theory, reduce the infection rate with Borrelia. So it's very targeted to the agent of Lyme disease. Mm-hmm. We think that one of the really underexploited, if we think about how we got in this problem, it's that there are more deer than there have ever been historically. I think you mentioned earlier that you don't remember seeing deer as a kid as often as we see them now. That's what's driving this, is there's more deer. Those are the predominant adult hosts for the black-legged ticks and the Lone Star ticks. So what we're trying to focus is on ways that we might be able to kill ticks on deer and reduce the burden of ticks on those deer.
Yeah, we had that on Nantucket. I don't know if they're still doing that with the stations where it was treating the deer, and obviously it. We're still seeing, cases of Lyme disease, and I wonder, is that still happening? Do you know, or is that happening other places?
It's not. We were involved with that project. That was an EPA project. It was on the Nantucket, the Vineyard, and the Cape. There were several sites. And the idea is it's called a four-poster. It's an apparatus that has corn hoppers in it where the corn comes out and the deer come in to feed on the corn. They rub up against paint rollers. They get treated with a product like permethrin that kills the ticks on the deer. The problem is, first of all, it feeds the deer, which is problematic because it's just making more deer. And the other is it feeds things that are off-target species like raccoons and squirrels and everything else. And so it's not effective at treating ticks on them. There's just a lot of problems with them in application. And then that study found that to really be effective, they had to be used at much higher density. In other words, you had to have many more of these apparatuses than one could afford to operate. And so
Yeah, that's when it
wasn't
gets
seen as an
costly. Yeah.
effective way.
Educating people about how to prevent tick bites and what to do if bitten is key. So, how do we do that in a region with so many visitors, especially since people may become infected and return to a place where tick-borne illness isn't so common? And I guess, Patrick, that's a question for you. You think of all the visitors you have in the vineyard in the summer, how do you go about educating them?
Yeah, that's one of my biggest struggles with my current position is, we get the influx of 150,000 in visitors. So it's trying to communicate and, let out this public information with different many avenues as possible. So we have brochures, we do the radio show, we do local talks at the libraries, try and get connected with as many organizations as possible.
Yeah. Just have a couple of minutes left. So just wondering about final thoughts. Stephen, any thoughts on the horizon that I didn't ask you about that you want to say?
Just one thought in the question you just asked, Patrick. So think about going to tickencounter.org. So that's our partners at the University of Rhode Island. And that has great information. Like if you're from outside the area and you're going to be traveling and spending time in the Cape and the Islands, look at Tick Encounter and you can get a lot of information about how to keep yourself tick safe.
Yeah. And Patrick, again, I think Dr. Lepre said it best, tick checks. Check yourself, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And last bit of advice from you?
Yeah, for me, it's personal protection. If you want to prevent tick bites, you start with protective clothing that covers you up as much as possible. You tuck it in to keep the ticks off your clothing. Then use a permethrin treatment or repellent. And then all of that fails, you follow up with your tick checks. And then if you do tick checks regularly, that really helps in reducing tick bites and the risk of tick-borne disease.
All right. We're going to post a link with more information, with links to the Tick Report, the New England Center for Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases, and the Martha's Vineyard Tick Program at our website, capeandislands.org. Stephen Rich is professor of microbiology at UMass Amherst and director of the New England Center of Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases, and Patrick Roden Reynolds, public health biologist and head of the Martha's Vineyard Tick Program. Thanks so much for being here today and bringing this really important info to our listeners. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.